Welcome to this special edition of Forthright Radio. On July 18, 2017, award-winning author and journalist Keith McCafferty came to the Beyond the Deep End studio in Bozeman, Montana, for an interview which lasted over 2¾ hours. His sixth Sean Stranahan mystery novel, Cold Hearted River, had just been published, and the fifth, Buffalo Jump Blues, had just come out in paperback. In this two-part series, we offer a distillation of what he had to say that day. He began by explaining why he still writes for Field & Stream magazine, where he had been an editor-contributor for decades. And then he talked about growing up in rural Appalachian, Ohio. And now, Keith McCafferty.
And the novel really gets you down psychologically, at least me. It's so hard to do. And I always feel like I'm failing. So if I write this or like write that story about growing up in Michigan, it's like a little piece of carpentry. It's small and I can see it and it's finished and people tell me it's good and I read it and think, well, yes, it is good. And then it gives me just a little bit of confidence to come back to work on the book, which I have no confidence in writing at all. So that's the real reason I still do that. Well, one of them.
Well, am I correct that is how your career began, was writing for Field & Stream?
That's right. Well, so can I tell you a little bit about growing up to that point? So I grew up in a region of Appalachia in southeast Ohio with 32% adult illiteracy rate in some parts of the county. I liked snakes, and I was in a place where people were superstitious and hated snakes, my grandmother in particular. And so at an age when I think a lot of children revere adults and believe that adults do know something, I knew that they didn't know anything. And the only way I could learn about snakes was to read about them. So my mother taught me how to read when I was 4. And by the time I was in kindergarten, I knew all 240-some species. And so my grandmother, Nanol, she was really steeped in superstition, and she would stick towels, and you know, around the cracks in the door because she knew I had snakes and was afraid that they'd get her. And she'd say, well, honey child, I seen that hoop snake, you know, bite his tail and roll down the hill and strike that boy dead. And, you know, how can you argue with that? I would sit in church with her, and she'd be looking at me, and while the preacher's talking, you know, I've got no interest in what he's saying. I'm a little kid. I'm writing down the Latin names of 230 species of snakes, and she's looking at this Latin, and she thinks that I'm conversing with the devil. She really did. But she'd tell my mom, this is just not right, you know. So to me, I had to learn the truth about snakes when my mother, who worked in a children's library, got me the complete Sherlock Holmes. That book was that big, and it would dent my chest. That also was like a search for the truth. So I think it was sort of natural that I gravitated towards mystery fiction years later. But what really happened that made me want to be a writer is I was enamored of a man named Jim Corbett, who hunted man-eating tigers in India and probably ended up doing more to save the tiger in India than anyone except Indira Gandhi. And is still probably the most revered person of European descent in India. And he hunted man-eating tigers, and he wrote books about it. Our car broke down once when I was 9 years old, and we were traveling to take a vacation out west, which we'd never done, in a Volkswagen camper, which were pieces of junk mechanically back then. And it broke down, and we ended up being towed into Denver. And I could see these white clouds above the skyline of Denver. And at a certain point, I realized that those were mountains. And I'd never seen mountains before. Not like that. I'd seen the Appalachians, but nothing like that. And so my father was very upset because we were going to spend a couple days in Denver getting the motor worked on. But I wasn't, because they dropped me off at the public library in downtown Denver. And I was able to read a couple of the stories Jim Corbett wrote. And so when I walked out of that library, I knew I wanted to live a life of adventure, but I really wanted to write about it as well. And so I knew at that age that's what I wanted to become a writer, and I knew exactly what kind of a writer I wanted to become. And I wanted to become the fishing editor of Field & Stream magazine. Al McLean was the fishing editor, and he was my hero. And I used to cut out all his articles. and I wanted to meet Al McLean and impress him. I wanted to marry his daughter, who was a beautiful young woman at that point. I'd been in my mid-teens, and take his job as the editor of Field & Stream. One thing he could do that almost no one in the world could do is he could take a 90-foot fly line, which is the whole length, and he could cast the whole length of it with his hands without using a rod. Well, that's not easy to do, but I did learn how to do that. Basically, you start with an 8.5-foot rod, and you just keep chopping it off until you've got a stick in your hand about 10 inches long, and then you can get rid of that. I learned how to do it. I became, at that point, I was already writing stories for Field & Stream, and I was sort of like a junior person coming up, and he was the editor emeritus. And I was supposed to meet him at one of the cabins that he stayed in on the Madison River just outside Ennis. And he died, sort of unexpectedly, at a fairly young age. So I never met Al McLean. I never married his daughter. I never took his job, but I came close. I ended up writing, 1,500 articles for Field & Stream, and counting still. So that's how I got involved with Field & Stream.
Before Field & Stream, You did work with Habitat Restoration Program, spearheaded by Bill Buck.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I first started going to Michigan. My dad was an engineer on the Pennsylvania Railroad, locomotive engineer. And each summer, he'd take 5 weeks of vacation, or six sometimes, and we would always drive up to upstate Michigan and camp on the bank of the Ossabaw River. And they started doing that when I was 1 year old. And so every summer, I would go there, and I sort of felt like that's where I grew up. So when I eventually went to college, I knew that they did that restoration work. I'd seen the structures. It's a long time ago, and I can't really remember how it came about, but I got an address to send a letter to Bill Buck, who was sort of spearheaded the project, and he liked the idea of hiring a college kid when he was off in the summer. Because a lot of the people they hired, we called Jack Pine Savages, who were some of my best friends. But people who worked there in the summertime, drew unemployment in the winter, or cut pulp. Anyway, I was sort of the ringer tossed in. And so I lived in the tent on the banks of the river for 3 summers and into the fall after I graduated from college. And so it was like an idyllic time for me. It was a wonderful time. And, of course, I fished there and met all kinds of characters, almost all of whom have faded away by now,
You built what is called the masterpiece
right.
in the Ossabaw River. and that actually appears in Cold Hearted River, which
That's
is
right.
your latest book. So tell us about your building it, and then we can get into Cold
Hearted
River.
What happened was, we would build all kinds of things, stump covers, bank riprap, small islands in the river, because the canoe traffic would beat away what's called the cedar sweepers, the white cedars whose limbs came down over the water, and that provided habitat and shade for the trout. Because the canoes destroyed some of that, we would build other habitat that they could stay under. And at one point, Bill, I was his crew foreman of one of the crews, and he just gave me carte blanche, just build whatever you want here. So I built an island about 60 feet long and 10 feet wide and planted trees on it. Because the Ossabaw is one of the most stable rivers in the world, being a seepage spring river, it doesn't have huge fluctuations of water level each year. So I built that in 1974, and it's still there. And it looks almost like the day I made it. Different trees are growing on it. And I remember kissing my girlfriend, Vicky, there, who's in the book. But I better not use her last name because I don't know if she'd approve, and I don't know where she is.
Yeah, I've got the list of the first that you were talking about. Oh, it was your first big trout,
right.
First beer too many, as you mentioned, first kiss, and first Massasauga rattlesnake?
Massasauga or Massauga, it's just a species of rattlesnake. I've always been, as I already told you, I've always been fascinated by snakes, and this snake was at the side of the dusty, sandy road. I pinned his head down and picked it up and carried it into the field to release it because I didn't want it to get hit by a car. But I'd handled many, many venomous snakes to that point. At this point, I've handled hundreds, but I no longer handle them. My wife is, you know, she didn't like that. I had a baby rattlesnake in her apartment once for a few days, and that didn't go over too well, so...
Well, you mentioned your grandmother.
Yeah.
And in one of your books, mm-hmm. The prologue or introduction, you talk about your Aunt Jackie Bailey. Mm-hmm. And I'm quoting you here. You said, matchmaker, dog boarder, doctor of dubious mail order degrees, who mended spiritually broken children with a wave of her fairy godmother wand, or when the body needed more succor than a 70-year-old woman wearing a prom dress and face glitter could provide, passed herself off as a physician and cajoled specialists into seeing patients they otherwise would never have seen. You quote her, "You're just whirring away in there, aren't you?" Jackie once told a little boy whose thoughts were so jumbled he found it hard to talk. "Someday you'll be a writer, and I will say I knew you when."
That's right.
Tell us more about your Aunt Jackie Bailey.
Well, she was sort of a free spirit back in the time when that might have been frowned upon. They lived out in the country about 8 miles from where we grew up, so I spent a lot of time with my cousins there, who will be happy to hear this, maybe, Brooke, Sean, and Drew. Jackie was my mother's brother's wife. Her brother was a game warden in two counties there in southeastern Ohio. And Jackie always had something going on. You know, we would visit a haunted house and spend the night there. Or she would have access to the first biofeedback machine in that part of Ohio. And she was just remarkable because she just did whatever she wanted in life. The rules did not apply to her. And at one point, she even got Jonas Salk on the phone, the poliovax. Well, Jonas Salk was notoriously reclusive. You just didn't call him. And she wanted to know something, and he said, "Lady, you managed to reach me. You can do this on your own." But she'd simply call, like, a specialist in Cleveland and say, "I've got a patient down here who really needs to see you." And by God, they'd see her. And the little fairy godmother thing, that happened when it was a tragedy. A family got involved in a car accident, and the mother and the father and the little boy were killed. The only person who survived it was the girl, and she would not speak, and did not speak for weeks and weeks and weeks. And Jackie, who was 70 then, dressed up, you know, like a fairy godmother with her little dime store tiara and her wand and her face glitter, and pranced into the room and said, "My name is Jackie Bailey. I'm your fairy godmother. What's your name, little girl?" And, you know, pronged her with her little thing. And she started to speak. And she was a matchmaker, and she made, as far as we know, about 16 matches, almost all of which ended in marriage. And some of those are still coming out, you know, that we didn't really know. Anyway, she was a remarkable person, and probably the first person who saw that I might want to be a writer, with the exception of my mother.
You dedicate one of your books to your mother.
This last one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was going to dedicate it to Valerie Hemingway, who did help me, who was a great friend of Ernest Hemingway, and married his youngest son. But my mother's 95, and I figured I should dedicate this book to her.
I'm wondering, one of the characters in your latest book, Cold Hearted River, is named Jolene May Bailey with the same spelling.
Yes, that's
right.
Is
that an homage?
Yes, of course. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In Cold Hearted River, you write a lot about the survival aspects. It's not like a major part of the book in the sense of how many pages it occupies, but in terms of impact, I think it's quite solid in there. At the very first few
pages.
Yeah.
That's actually based on a true story. As the survival editor for Field and Stream, I gathered a lot of stories of people who were in peril in the wilderness. One was a case of two hunters from Idaho. I ended up speaking to the one man, and they were caught in a blizzard. They were elk hunting, and they really believed that they were going to die, and that the only solution they could figure out was night, was to shoot their horses and try to climb inside horses, which you hear about, but is not a very easy thing to do, and not very comfortable, as they found out. they just couldn't bring themselves to kill their own horses. So they shot each other's horses. They did manage to survive the night inside the carcasses. And when dawn came, the sky cleared and they were able to see their truck. That's how close they were. So I had that.
Well, it doesn't really matter, though.
I had
it?
That story sort of percolating around, and I wanted to incorporate something like that at the beginning of this book.
As you said, it's in the very, very first pages of the book. Mm-hmm. One of your Field and Streams articles is entitled "Build a Survival Fire with Condoms and Underwear."
I remember that.
And also, since you've been speaking about your wife, you talk about how you experiment to write these articles, and your wife confronts you when she finds one of the condoms.
That's right. Well, see, in theory, you can start a fire by directing the sun's rays through a condom with water in it and start a fire. Mm-hmm. And I did, but it was an awful lot of work. Probably wouldn't work in a real survival situation. Now, burning underwear, that works like a charm, but it has to be cotton. So there are all these people who die in the wilderness and they can't get kindling or, you know, to start a fire, and here they're wearing something that will do it. That will save them.
Well, what do? Shred the...
Sure. If you can get a flame going, then cotton will really go up and sustain a flame long enough probably to get some smaller branches going. That actually does work, and I incorporated that into this book as well.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, right.
One of the characters wasn't wearing cotton, but the other one was.
That's right.
So, but it came directly
from that article.
Well, in a blizzard, though, taking off whatever clothing you have on to get to your cotton underwear.
Well, in this case, they didn't really take it off. I've been out in weather so cold that you can't take any clothing off.
Right.
You can only put stuff on if you're lucky. 42 degrees below zero, that's the coldest I've been hunting. I'm the one to be dropped off on the top of a mountain and have 3 days to hike out dressed in a Hawaiian shirt, basically, and try to survive. I ended up peeing on a little tarp, wrapping up in it. That was the low point. But I remembered that night that Field and Stream, that my editor there had asked me, he said, well, you do have a photo release on file with us, don't you? And I'm lying there, I'm thinking, is that so that they can, use my photographs if I die? Which would be a good story for them, you know. When I came back from that exercise, which was 3 days long, and the first day I just survived by digging in dirt under trees, and the second day by wrapping up in that little tarp. After that time, I thought, well, you know, maybe it's time to write that novel I always wanted to write. I'm getting too old for this.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that in preparing for this, I did look at your articles, and particularly your survival articles, and mm-hmm. I found them really fascinating. You are, in fact, an incredible writer, whether it's nonfiction or fiction. You just really have the gift.
Thanks. But, you know, it's different. The talent or the skills don't really transfer in a way. Newspaper articles and most magazine work, it's sort of driven by the declarative sentence, with or without subclauses. Whereas when you start writing novels, you find out immediately that novels are driven almost entirely by character and dialogue. And in my case, humor, hopefully. So in a way, it's like starting all over. And I was lucky because it's sort of the character and dialogue comes naturally to me. And if you'd told me that would sort of be my strength 15 years ago, I'd tell you were crazy. I was part of like 5 or 6 national magazine awards and twice just by myself writing sort of long, elegant narrative pieces. And I thought, that's what I do. That's what I know how to do. And then when I started writing the novels and character and dialogue, I thought, no, this is actually what comes most naturally to me. The plotting the novels, that's very difficult for me. On my mother's refrigerator, her house on the Missouri River, there's this saying, something like, if you can see your path laid out in front of you step by step, it's not your path. Mm. Your path you create with every step you take. Mm. And that's the way I realized when I wrote that. I said, that's the way I write a book. I usually have a scene that I start with, and that's in my head. And I often will have a theme, like the bison situation in the West. And I know it will be about that. And I sometimes will have the end in mind. But most of the book, nine-tenths of it, I don't really have a clue. So I just sort of start taking little steps and end up getting lost all the time.
So does that mean you have to do a lot of revision?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, an awful lot.
Well, let's get to character.
Sure.
The main character is Sean Stranahan.
Mm-hmm.
What is his genesis, both in you and then in the books?
Well, in me, it's that in the old days of magazine writing, if I had more than one or two articles in an issue, they would want me to write the third one under a pseudonym. So it didn't look like the entire magazine was written by one person. And I knew a kid in college named Michael Stranahan who was a friend of mine, and so all I did was change his first name. So that was a name that I used in journalism. And then I also used it in writing contests where you had to use a pseudonym. And the very first writing contest I ever won, I was in graduate school at the University of Michigan. The prize was I got to drive to upstate Michigan and hunt snowshoe rabbits on snowshoes with a basset hound. Was what I won. So last year, I was fortunate enough to win the Western Writers of America Spur Award for Best Contemporary Novel. And I had to give a speech to the Western Writers of America. And I remember telling them, this is only the second best prize I've ever won. My first one was hunting, you know, snowshoe rabbits on snowshoes with a basset hound.
So was that award for Buffalo Jump Blues?
No, that award was for Crazy Mountain Kiss.
Oh, for Crazy Mountain mm-hmm. Kiss, uh-huh.
Although I just found out yesterday that Buffalo Jump Blues is finalist for the Will Rogers Medallion Award for Best Western Fiction. So that was the genesis of how I came up with the name, when I had to come up with sort of a protagonist. I actually have two sort of protagonists. But
I'm glad you say that, because the other one is Martha, right?
Martha Ettinger, who's the sheriff, who's actually, there's a cowboy poet named Gwen Peterson, who's a friend of mine, who was a pig farmer. And I sort of modeled it after Gwen lightly. I just sort of subtracted 30 years from Gwen's age and then reimagined it. And, you know, originally my literary agent said, well, you know, that's not done, and that's sort of a dangerous thing to do in mystery fiction or any fiction, is to sort of have two equally weighted characters. Because usually you can get away with 80-20, you can get away with 70% one, 30% the other. Once you get down around 60-40, and that's about what mine are, 60-40. So you have to be a little careful because, you know, when they're on the page together, it's going to be seen through one of their eyes, but not the other. And I realize, well, it's going to be seen through whoever eyes are the, you know, the one that's sort of driving that particular little passage. One passage, it might be driven by Sean Stranahan, and so she will be seen through his eyes, and another time it'll be the other way around. But anyway, there she was, so I wanted her to play a big part in it. But I also wanted my character to, in this case, he's from Massachusetts. It probably should have been Michigan where I grew up. I don't know why the hell I used Massachusetts. I wanted him to come from somewhere else so that he saw the what I consider the changing West, the changing Rocky Mountain West anyway, with sort of fresh eyes. And I wanted to write about the West I knew, which is a rapidly changing West, where a lot of the big ranching families that own the valleys, you know, are parceling off land. So you have areas like the Madison River where you might have a state senator living next door to somebody who's raising medical marijuana, living next door to a fishing guide, living next door to a bartender, or, you know, just all kinds of people from different walks of life sort of walking together. So I did that deliberately. And also because there were other writers like Chuck Box, who's been very helpful in my career, and Craig Johnson, who sort of wrote about lone, iconic lawmen in these great, big, wide-open counties in Wyoming. And that's perfectly legitimate because those places do still exist, although there are far fewer, and I didn't want to try to duplicate that in Montana. I wanted it to be sort of the West that I saw, where the economy's driven by, you know, the slime of trout as much as it is agriculture or mining.
One of the things I really admire and enjoy in your books is the interplay between the genders, the sexes, the tensions, the confusions, the support, the aggravation, You do a marvelous job.
Oh, well, thanks. Nobody mentions that. You're the first person I think that's ever said that.
Well, I've been talking to other people, some of whom have not read your books, and they get my enthusiasm, and they say, well, can I just pick up the latest book? And I say, no, you really shouldn't. You really should begin at the beginning. There's tremendous character development, for one thing, but there's also history that happens
by the characters,
sixth.
Right.
Yeah, and...
Now, I do deliberately write the book so they don't have to be read in order. If I had a weakness at the beginning, it was partly that I didn't develop the characters fully. But I fully intended to develop them as the series went on so that there was some place to go. When you have to keep tension between the sexes, it's like the real reason that you don't want your protagonist, let's say it's a man, to have a wife is because she's there and vice versa. And then you have to deal with that person. And if that person doesn't play a part in the story, it just drags it down. So you have to be very careful like that. Same thing, you know, young men in Montana, like Sean Stranahan, who lives alone, would have a dog, right? Every young man in Montana has a dog. But you also have to be very careful with that, because where's the dog? I would write a manuscript and, you know, I have a dog, Chody, in the book, and I'd write on the margin, where's the damn dog? Because it has to be addressed. Is it in the truck with him? Is it staying with somebody else? And that's sort of one of the real reasons that so many protagonists in all kinds of books are people who are single. It's not because sexual tension is destroyed if once a couple gets married. It's that then you have to address the second person. Most of that I just do instinctively. Martha is a character who I always think of, somebody who seems gruff, but is basically unintentionally funny. She basically has affairs with two men, with Sean and then with Harold Littlefeather, who is the Blackfeet Indian character in the novel. And so I basically have like a love triangle, and that plays out differently in each book. And everybody asks me, well, are Martha and Sean going to get together? And I said, well, this, you know, just read this book. I think they might get a little closer together.
That brings up a real trick that you did in Cold Hearted River.
Mm-hmm.
Between pages 139 and 140, there's a chapter break there.
Uh-huh.
You do a startling transition from the character Marguerite.
Okay. Yes, because that's the name of a lake near there. It's actually Lake Marguerite, but I have her name is Marguerite.
Okay. But I just want you to know that that was one of the most startling chapter transitions I've ever encountered.
And I thought, well, should I really write this? Because I am sort of misleading the reader to a certain
sort degree. Sort of.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I'm really not. So, yeah, well, I hope I was able to pull that
you
off.
You did. It was brilliant once I got over my double take.
Right.
I've never seen that done before. And so anyway, kudos to you
for doing it.
I think you may have invented it. Since I'm being so careful not to give stuff away, I would like to give you the floor and say what you feel comfortable with for listeners to hear about this latest book, Cold Hearted River.
The one thing we haven't talked about is how I got the idea to do it. I can talk about that without giving anything away. The fact is that I used to be a junior sort of contributing editor to Field & Stream magazine. And another contributing editor was Jack Hemingway, Ernest Hemingway's oldest son. And we traveled sort of in the same circles, which basically meant he was a steelhead bum, and he spent a lot of time on the road fishing for steelhead in British Columbia and also in Oregon and Washington and Idaho. And I did as well. I was a wannabe steelhead bum, I say, who wanted to stay married and therefore never quite made the grade. So I'd get to go fishing a couple times a year, whereas Jack was out there for quite a bit of time. And we knew each other. I mean, he was not a friend of mine, but we were sort of colleagues in a distant way. And he was a very nice man. And he always knew when he was on the river because he'd be whistling. He constantly whistled. And he liked to fish alone. But one day, it would have been in late October, early November, way back in the early 1980s probably, I was fishing a run of the river called the Graveyard. And Graveyard's one of the most famous steelhead runs in the world. And it is just down the hill from a graveyard where all the graves point north. And I was sort of sharing this run with Jack, which basically meant he would go through the run and then I would, and we'd sort of leapfrog each other. And we'd exchange a few words whenever we passed by each other. And for some reason, we were the only two people on the river all day long, dawn till dark. And on towards dark, Jack hooked a big steelhead, and I helped him land it at the tail out of the graveyard run. And we admired it a minute, and, you know, a second, and let it go. It was about 15 or 16 pounds, which is a good steelhead. And at that time, my dad, who was not with me, he liked to carry a thermos of hot chocolate with a little bit of peppermint schnapps in it. And so I had a thermos of that sort of as a tribute to my dad. And so Jack and I drank that. And then I asked him if he thought his father would have enjoyed that kind of fishing. First, I was sort of afraid to ask him the question because he was his own man, and I didn't want to bring up the subject of his famous father. And the fact was Jack was probably, undoubtedly a better trout and steelhead fisherman than Ernest Hemingway ever was. So the first thing he said, which I have in an epigram here, is he said to me, he said, "Papa liked to say that all true stories end in death. I think the idea of fishing in a graveyard would have appealed to him." And he sort of made that comment sort of as a throwaway comment. I mean, I might not have the exact wording, but that's basically what it was. And then he said sort of more seriously that his father had lost all interest in fly fishing for trout and steelhead when a steamer trunk containing all of his excellent fishing gear was stolen or lost by the Railway Express in 1940. And that was the year that he was a guest at the Sun Valley Lodge in Idaho. He was so devastated by the loss of his fishing tackle, which he had great sentimental attachment to, that he only went fishing one more time. And I think that was in the Big Wood River. And I think that may have been actually just a photo opportunity for a magazine like Looker Life. And years and years and years passed, and I didn't think much of that story. And then my wife, Gail Schonsler, who's a reporter for the Bozeman Daily Chronicle, decided to go to Northwest Wyoming to write about Ernest Hemingway's life there. Between the years of 1930 and 1940, he spent five summers and long falls at a guest ranch outside Cook City, Montana, where he hunted and fished and where he wrote many of his most famous pieces. That's where he worked a little bit on the end of A Farewell to Arms and wrote most of For Whom the Bell Tolls, as well as To Have and Have Not, I think, and also some of his short stories. And it's the least known period of his life, or the least documented. And so we went down there. I went to sort of help her do research, to try to see the cabin where he used to stay and see various places that he had visited. She said, "You know, you should try to work this into one of your books." And I said, "Well, you know, I've got this story. I know about his missing fishing tackle." And anyway, when I decided to do it, it's such a long time had passed, and Jack had died many years before, that I sort of wanted to verify details of it or learn more. So I did turn to Patrick Hemingway, the only surviving son, and Patrick remembered it very well, and he said he can remember that his father had a devil of a time converting pounds sterling into American dollars when he would order fishing gear from Hardy Brothers in London. He would help him do that, Patrick would. And he did say that was a great tragedy in his life. He had great sentimental attachment. So I thought, well, nobody really knows what was in that steamer trunk. There could have been manuscripts in there. There could have been other Hemingway memorabilia. There were certainly rods and reels, and some of which may have had his initials on them, or we just don't know. But the fact is, it does exist, it did exist, and that stuff is out there floating around somewhere. And I thought, well, I will try to build a story around this. I was reluctant at first because anytime you have a character in a book, and I have a character in the book who feels like he can summon Ernest Hemingway's pen, if not his spirit, you sort of risk the, you know, writing a caricature and sort of making a fool out of yourself. And the other thing is sort of like Day of the Jackal, in the sense that everyone in France and most of the world knows that Charles de Gaulle did not meet his death by a sniper's bullet, and yet Frederick Forsyth wrote a compelling novel about that. And I sort of knew, well, you know, that fishing tackle has never really surfaced, but I'm going to write about it anyway. And sort of like his, you know, the lost manuscripts that his wife Hadley lost way back in the 1920s. This is the second loss of his life. You know, doesn't have maybe as valuable stuff as his earlier stories, but still, it was very valuable to him. That's the story I tried to weave into this, the search for that, like a treasure hunt. People always ask you which was your favorite book, and most writers say, well, it's the one I'm working on now, which I like to think is a cop-out. But at the same time, I understand it because you've gone through the others so many times that it's almost like somebody else wrote them. But The Grey Ghost Murders has a special place for me because that's where I raised my blackbirds, my little birds that I'm sort of a wild bird rescue person. I wrote that story sitting under a sun umbrella in my backyard and feeding birds every 15 minutes.
Well, you allude to that in your prologue, and I didn't know what the heck it meant. You seem to imply that they had saved you or saved the novel.
They taught me how to write a little bit because when you only can write in 15-minute bursts, you better put something down on the page. Otherwise, I'm one of those writers who could spend the morning like Oscar Wilde, you know, putting in a comma in the afternoon, taking it out. The birds made me put one word after the other.
Say a little about fly fishing and the mystique of fly fishing.
It's the best immersion into nature, at least in rivers, that I know of. It's sort of an end unto itself, and it has great therapeutic value to me. I always say, you know, that I don't write fly fishing mysteries. I write mystery books that have a very little amount of fly fishing in them, usually no more than one or two scenes. So I'm sorry I lose readers who have no interest. If they would read the books, they'd find out it's just like, you know, one scene. They actually have round table discussions. It's actually an oval table in the Penguin offices in New York City, where they'll decide whether I have too many fly fishing scenes or too few. And so my first book, Catherine Court, the publisher and president of Penguin, who is my editor, suggested that I remove a couple scenes. For The Grey Ghost Murders, my second novel, she suggested I add one. It's a very fine balance because I can't write down to people who understand things or I lose credibility, but I can't write technically and lose the interest of lay people or whatever who have no interest. Now, one thing that is interesting about The Grey Ghost Murders is that book was promoted a lot by Novato Barr, who is a very famous author. And somebody had sent her that book for a possible blurb. She doesn't give out blurbs. And she took one look at the cover of it, which had a fly on it, and she said, I'm not interested in that. And the next day, Hurricane Isaac struck New Orleans, where she lives, and she was without power for 3 days. And she read that book, and then she got a narrated version of the first book, liked the book so much that she wanted me to send her books, and now I send her little presents, and you know, I did a stop on a book tour with her, and she's been very supportive of me. Mm-hmm. That was an instance where she took a look at the cover and had no interest in it. So after that, Penguin did decide that they did not want to put flies on the cover of the book. So now I have them on the inside flap or on the spine, but not on the cover. And it's sort of legitimate because they're really not books that have very much fishing at all.
So in some of your later books, you begin addressing conflicts between wildlife and humans. In Dead Man's Fancy, it's wolves.
Right.
And you consulted Robert Millage.
I wrote an article about him for Field and Stream magazine. He was the first person in 75 years or whatever to legally shoot a wolf, and he did it in Idaho. And I wrote a long piece where I interviewed people on both sides of the issue, and he was just part of it. Whenever possible, I try to write a small, sort of an intimate story, a people story, set against a larger backdrop issue. And in that case, it was wolves. Dead Man's Fancy, it was wolves. In Buffalo Jump Blues, it was the big controversy over Yellowstone bison. In the next book I am writing, it takes place on the Smith River, which is endangered by a proposed copper mine. And so I like to have that greater backdrop issue, but I try not to be real political and, you know, writing about it or overwhelm. It's just sort of there to paint the story against. Characters have their own opinions.
You do it through characters, and mm-hmm. I think you do just an outstanding job. You have managed to condense the sentiment of that and express it really concisely, and I think even handedly about it. For example, you have a semi-recurring character, Calvin Bob.
That's right, yeah.
Who's in charge of animal damage control.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't you talk about that side of things?
I made up that character. It's loosely based on a real person whose name escapes me right now, but he wrote a book called Wolfer about his life as somebody who had trapped wolves, mostly to kill them, but he was one of the people involved in catching the wolves in southern Alberta that were then released in Yellowstone Park in the middle of Idaho as well. And he is somebody who is loved and hated by equally on both sides, because he insists on getting to the bottom of things and finding out if a wolf really was responsible for cattle killing or whatever, which sometimes makes the ranchers upset with him because they just want to assume that the wolf does and get whatever they can out of that. He gets lambasted by the wolf lovers because he has been known to kill wolves. So one thing that happened in his life is that some of the very wolves that he ended up releasing, he later had to kill because they, for one reason or another. To me, he's a very interesting person, and he wrote a wonderful book. If I had a character who worked for animal damage control and who was a wolfer, somebody who killed wolves for a living in a sense, and also would have to shoot bison under the existing laws, I wanted him to be not just a knee-jerk kind of character, but somebody who was more complex and somebody who loved the very animals that they sometimes had to kill.
You actually get into, and again, this is very brief snippets in the larger mystery,
mm-hmm.
but Honest Abe ranchers versus ranchers who cry wolf. One of your characters, he's not actually there, but his journal is crucial in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a list of Honest Abe ranchers versus ranchers who cry wolf. And you also have a list of real causes of livestock deaths.
Right. And a lot of that is taken from what I know, not only from the Wolfer book, but as a journalist, I was one of the very first people to write about the introduction of wolves into
right.
Yellowstone and interviewed the person who, I forget his name, who was sort of spearheaded that. So I was involved from the beginning, and I would see it from the side of elk hunters who don't like wolves and ranchers who hate wolves and people who love wolves, and find that it's an extremely complex subject,
mm-hmm.
and every single drainage in Montana has a different dynamic at work. You can have situations where wolves actually increase the elk population because the cows give birth to more calves, and there's only a few areas where wolves actually deplete the population. And in those cases, there's usually a tipping point that has already been reached with predation from black bears, grizzly bears, and mountain lions, and coyotes. And when you add the wolf to the mix,
mm.
the elk herds go down. But what the wolves definitely do is the presence of wolves on the landscape changes the behavior of elk. And so when a lot of hunters are complaining that our elk are being killed by the wolves, that's really not true. There are just as many elk as there ever were. But the wolves have changed their behavior.
So you mean they become warier?
Well, they become warier. They change their group size.
Oh.
They hang out in more remote areas. And they also go down onto the flat ranch lands much earlier. So you used to have ranchers that would have to feed elk, say, in January, February, and March. Well, now those ranchers are feeding elk basically for 6 months, because as soon as the hunting season rolls around, they drop down into the valleys. So as a result, you get the ranchers upset with the number of elk there, and you get the hunters upset because they no longer have access, especially on public land, to hunt those elk. So it's a very complex thing, and wolves, when they're added to the mix, all different kinds of things can happen. And it really just depends on where you are and what the existing dynamic is. In a place like the Madison Valley, there is never going to be a lot of problem with wolves killing cattle because it's such a developed area. And as soon as wolves kill something, well, the pack is basically shot. In other more remote areas in the state, wolves can have more of an impact.
Well, again, you incorporate a great deal of information, not just about like the science, as you were just talking about, but also the interplay of real people around the issue. Right.
Theodore Thackeray, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Coordinator, who was in charge of forming the Interagency Bison Management Plan and was subsequently fired. In real life, that's Arnie Dude. And basically, Arnie was seen as too sympathetic to the plight of the bison and offered a completely different job. And now I think he just retired, more or less. So I wanted to have Arnie in the book.
That's in your book, Buffalo Jumps Blues, that you introduced the character of Thackeray, to whom you were just referring. And again, you do a wonderful job of discussing the issues around bison, which goes back to the elk, because the big bugaboo is brucellosis.
That's right.
So the bison, as soon as they step off of Yellowstone boundaries, they're fair game. Whereas the elk can basically go anywhere they want.
And they also carry brucellosis.
Exactly.
And they are on the same calving grounds with cattle. So if brucellosis is transferred, it's much more likely transferred from elk than it is from bison. But nobody raises a red flag about elk because they are such a valuable big game animal and they bring millions of dollars into the state. If buffalo brought as much money into the state, people would be really thinking twice about killing them when they step across an imaginary line. There is some concern about elk and brucellosis, but basically, brucellosis was sort of an excuse to shoot bison. Everybody knows that. Since there's never been a single case of bison ever transferring brucellosis to cattle, it does seem like a scare tactic more than anything else.
In your book, Buffalo Jump Blues, you also do the interplay between several different Native tribes and the European Americans. And you use the term that I had not heard before, and it's so perfect, Windians, wannabe Indians.
Wannabe Indians,
You're kind of your villains in that book.
Right, they're sort of Windians.
Or at first they're taken to be.
They're taken to be, right. They're actually pretty bad dudes. But
oh, your villains could be pretty bad, yes.
You know, I have Native people review my books, especially a couple of the books, Buffalo Jump Blues in particular. I had Marcia Small read that book.
Well, I do need to ask you a question about something you say in Buffalo Jump Blues about Standing Rock in 1883 when 10,000 bison sacrificed themselves to the Lakota, or the Lakota believed that they did.
That's right.
Is that a real event?
Yes, that's all. Yes, and I can't remember the details now that you put me on the spot, but basically between the Lakota and the white hunters there was sort of an imaginary line drawn, and there were actually fires built by the Indians to keep the bison on their side, and both sides killed the bison until there were basically none standing. And there were some Lakota people who believed that those were the last bison on earth, more or less. They weren't, but you know, of course, but that was the last great buffalo hunt in which the white people and the Indians both partook.
Early on in Buffalo Jump Blues, there's a herd of buffalo that leave Yellowstone, and there are protectors of the bison. You call them the American Bison Crusade.
Right. There's a real group of people who I've interviewed and actually walked with in their marches.
So Sheriff Martha, very reluctantly and not very gracefully, gets stuck with this bison calf. And it causes all sorts of problems.
The fact that she has a bison calf that she's trying to raise for a few weeks until it can be released back hopefully to his mother, if they could ever find it, is sort of a vehicle for me to be able to talk about various issues surrounding the bison. So I knew right off the bat that when Harold put the bison out of their misery that had been driven over the cliff, that there would be one left that he would take. That little baby bison would be a big controversy with the Stock Growers Association, saying you cannot keep a wild animal. And it was sort of a vehicle to get some of the political and biological issues surrounding it into the book.
It brings up the curious situation in Montana where bison, who, after all, is one of the symbols of the United States.
It's our national animal.
It's honored as being wildlife, and yet in Montana, it's regulated under the Department of Livestock.
Right, it's regulated like livestock.
Yeah. Martha, who's the sheriff, very reluctantly, the powers that be are after her, and I love what you have. It's sort of a tiny little denouement, trying to get a judge to issue a warrant on her. And it turns out that the judge, after listening to the Department of Livestock's argument, and they go, one, two, three, all these things that Martha's guilty of, declines to give the warrant as written because of the inherent contradictions involved. And it kind of gets left there, but I love that you had that happen. I wish it would actually happen in real life.
All the issues I write about are still on the table today. Yeah. And the new bison interagency management plan has still not been formulated.
I have one little, I wouldn't want to say bone to pick.
Uh-oh.
But
I'm in trouble.
I think I've already told you that I volunteer at the library mending books. And to me, librarians are a special class. You know where this is going, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just want to know, how did that evolve? I don't want to give anything away.
I have a character who's a sexy librarian, and then some. Well, there actually is a group of librarians who call themselves the Naked Librarians, and they put out posters and stuff. And I've spoken to a couple of groups. I've spoken in San Francisco to the American Library Association, and in Denver to the Public Library Association. And these are cases where there's huge numbers of people attend, like 22, 25,000 people, the American Library Association. Not that I speak to that many. I'll address them. I'll say, well, I know now why you've invited me because, you know, I'm the only writer sitting here who has a sexy librarian in the book. And then, and I remember distinctly some woman jumping up said, all librarians are sexy. And then they start telling me about these, you know, sexy librarian groups where they've, like nude librarians' calendars. And so I don't think I'm really off base here, you know, to have this character. And that's what inspired me to do that. But, you know, I don't know why I make up stuff somehow.
We're speaking of a character in Crazy Mountain Kiss.
Right.
It seems like in your later novels, each of them has an animal that is dealt with.
I have somebody who is so desperate for warmth that they climb into a bear's den in the winter. And I had heard a story about that, something like that happening in the Yukon. I don't know if it's been verified, and I couldn't find it. And the irony, of course, the truth is there are a couple real problems with that. Number one is bears don't really hibernate. They go into some sort of stupor or sleep, but they can be roused from that quite quickly and become vicious or attack people quite quickly if they go climb in there. The other thing is that the bears are so well insulated by their fur that they only raise the temperature in the cave by a few degrees in their dens. So somebody who climbs in there in an effort to get warm might get a little bit warmer, but it won't be a lot. That book, Cold Hearted River, is about desperate people. Mm-hmm. All the people in it are desperate people. And this is an indication of what desperate people will resort to. They'll do whatever they can. I was invited by the district ranger of Flathead National Forest, Dave Owen, and by my old friend Joe Gakoski, who I dedicated Buffalo Jump Blues to, who's 90 now, go into the Bob Marshall Wilderness in the heart of winter. And because they used to do that twice a winter on skis or snowshoes to do snow gauge studies. They're not allowed to go in there in a helicopter or plane because it's a wilderness area. And that's when I first found out about the bear doors and the bear windows and those old cabins that they have in the middle of the Bob Marshall Wilderness. They would put up planks over windows with spikes sticking out to deter grizzly bears from breaking in. When I went in with Dave Owen and Joe Gutkowski, and there was one other person, we skied in from Spotted Bear. Dave had the keys, so each night we would spend a night in one of the old cabins. And we were down way down towards Big Prairie. We'd gone a long way near the outlet of Big Salmon Lake. There is a cabin there. And here, somebody had broken into it. And it was two marten trappers. And the one marten trapper had stepped on one of those bear doors that was covered by snow and driven a spike all the way through his foot. So they had taken shelter in the cabin, and because he was in not good enough shape to limp out at that point. And as we approached that cabin, even before we saw any smoke coming from it, my friend Joe would say, well, one of these people who's leaving these snowshoe tracks is limping, you know, because they're favoring one foot. And sure enough, and this guy became sort of a famous trapper in the state of Montana, and he's still alive, and I'm trying to get a photograph that I took to him through Julie Cunningham, who's an elk biologist here, who's a friend of this man, who I haven't seen now in 30 years or more. But here's this guy who's driven the spike through his foot. My job that evening was to snowshoe alone up to the inlet of Big Salmon Lake, which is quite a ways, and catch trout, enough trout to bring back to feed our little group, which I did, which was an extraordinary experience because you are as far from human beings as you can get in that part of the Bob Marshall Wilderness. And I had to ski all the way across Big Salmon Lake, which is an enormous lake, and find this little inlet, catch the fish, come back. And you're so much aware of bears on the landscape in that area, even though the bears were hibernating at that time. And so that evening, that young man, whose name I can't remember, is a very good-looking, very powerful young man. He told the best grizzly bear story I have ever heard, and I won't get into that in too much detail, but he used to work for an elk outfitter, and when the outfitter would leave, because the season is very short, the hunting season ends quickly there because of the snow, you can't get in, they would leave him a little one-man tent, and he would live through the winter by himself trapping marten. And early in the fall, of course in November, a lot of the bears aren't yet in the dens. He'd shot a spike bull elk and the bear had confiscated the carcass, and he decided he was at war with this bear and he had tracked it and actually shot at it once and was afraid at another time that he'd be killed by it. I wrote that story called Where Trees Grow Too Close Together. Dave Petzl, an editor, gave it a ridiculous title, I think, just to spite me. It was like The Cabin Where Terror Came Calling. He came up with that title. That story has been anthologized several times in books, and I always insisted that it have my title, Where Trees Grow Close Together, or maybe Too Close Together. It's been anthologized in books like Best American Hunting Stories, stuff like that. I think Field & Stream reissued it as part of like Five Greatest Hunting Stories Ever Told or something.